Hello and welcome to Aspen Physician Spotlight. I am your host, Vikram Christian. Today I have the pleasure of meeting with and talking to a colleague and friend, Dr. Senthil Sankararaman. Dr. Sankararaman is an associate professor at the Case Western Reserve University Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition under the Department of Pediatrics. He also works at the Rainbow Babies Children's Hospital. Dr. Sankararaman, Senthil, thank you for spending this time.
Thank you so much, Vikram. Thanks for having me. Thanks for your introduction. Very excited to be here.
Excellent. So, Senthil, I was wondering if we could start off by talking a little bit more about what led you to the field of nutrition.
Okay, so I did my med school in India. After that, I decided to go into pediatrics. So that I did not have much struggle or issues in selecting it. I love working with children. So as you know, as a pediatric clinician, nutrition and evaluating nutrition, growth and development is integral part of pediatrics. So always had a love for nutrition. And then I had a great opportunity to go to United Kingdom, UK for a few years. And the training in UK is a little bit different, but I was very fortunate to work in level three NICU, neonatal ICUs in both Nottingham and Manchester. So that was my the initial exposure to critical care nutrition. So to TPN, feeding tubes. So, and again, that kind of like increased my love and passion towards nutrition. And at the time, the National Health Services in UK was undergoing a major restructuring. So some of my friends went to Australia. Some of my friends came to US. So at the time I was young, kind of like I was like, okay, let's go to United States and explore more. I was just more curious to explore different medical systems and pros and cons. So I came here. So I did my residency in Louisiana State University, Shreveport. So I had the fortunate to work with one of legendary pediatric gastroenterologists. His name is John Herbst, Dr. John Herbst. So he's probably the reason who drove me towards pediatric gastroenterology. So then I joined fellowship in Rainbow Babies Children's Hospital, which is an excellent hospital. I was training myself as a general pediatric gastroenterologist with love for like pancreatic diseases, mucosal diseases, liver. So, and then after finishing my training, I had an opportunity for to stay there as a faculty. And my division chief, he was asking about like, okay, we need a person who wants to expand the nutritional services beyond Shotgut. Will you be interested in? So to be honest, I mean, as nutrition kind of like comprises a wide and broad range of field. I was a little bit kind of like not sure which way I need to go. So NASPGHAN, our pediatric GI society, so as you know, it conducts a 1 day course called NASPGHAN Nutrition University, NTU. That was the main, that was the first time I saw like so many mentors with pediatric nutrition focused. And that meeting gave me really a good idea about like what are all the avenues, what are all the opportunities available in pediatric nutrition for the gastroenterologist, and where we can kind of like expand our career, things like that. So that was probably my branching point towards love for what I'm doing now in nutrition. And at the time I was looking for, I thought like if I do an advanced fellowship that will strengthen my nutrition knowledge, and the Nestle Nutrition Fellowship actually came to my mind, and I applied it, which I was skeptical because it's mainly critical care nutrition and adult nutrition focus. Coming from pediatric background, I'm still very thankful to Dr. McClave and Dr. Martindale to select me for this, and that was a game changer. So this 4 weeks course, as you know, because you did after me, the 2 weeks in Louisville, 2 weeks in Oregon. Like almost like boot camp, but I would say in a good way that like it's so intense exposure to nutrition. So that's where my broad and depth of nutrition actually kind of like enriched in the sense that I got some idea about how the feeding a critically ill patient microbiome and nutrition, the interplay between the metabolomics, nutrition, and then body composition evaluation, indirect calorimetry, sarcopenia. So I can kind of add on like kind of more nuances of nutrition. That's where kind of like I learned. And then, so in my place, then I was focusing on kids with nutrition feeding issues, eating disorders, kids on enteral nutrition, both NG and G tube, things like that. And then around during just before the pandemic, my division chief, Dr. Safera, was in charge of CF in our center, and he was getting more and more busier in administrative things. And he offered me that, like, if you're interested in CF, there is a nice grant coming from the foundation. If you're interested, you can apply and you can get. So the name of the grant is called Digest. So it are both pediatric gastroenterologists and adult gastroenterologists who wants to enrich their CF knowledge or CF training. It's a very structured program. It runs for 3 years. Most of the training is online. Like every month we have another conference, which is more interactive, one person presenting and everyone chiming in. And then also the best part of the program is it protects our time. It's about like it protected 15 to 18% of my time. So which is a great thing to have. So we can devote more training, more time for CF. And also they pay for the NACFC, the North American Cystic Fibrosis Conference, once a year. So that's kind of like, even though I have seen patients, the patients with CF in the past, this structured training helped me to enrich more knowledge in CF.
Thank you for sharing that, Sandal. You have such a broad range of experience from India and UK and here in the US and CF and feeding disorders and nutrition support. Thank you for sharing all of that. You know, CF is, you know, very integral to pediatric nutrition. I think, you know, there's a lot of pediatric nutrition experts who focus on CF, which is very different from maybe how adult nutrition specialists might focus on. At least it's not a huge focus of the adult nutrition world. Can you share a little bit about the CF world and what specifically you do, the role of a nutrition expert in the care of a patient with CF? And also if there's been any recent like developments or updates that you feel like somebody who's focused on nutrition should be aware of.
Sure. So cystic fibrosis is the most common genetic condition in Caucasians. So throughout the world, about 70,000 people is estimated to live with CF. But it's in developing world is often either underdiagnosed condition or misdiagnosed as other entities. So in the developed world, it's majority of the patients are diagnosed through universal newborn screen. So the first description about CF came from Dr. Dorothy Anderson in 1938. So before that, it was recognized as most of the CF conditions are recognized as celiac disease because of the similarities between celiac and cystic fibrosis. So Dr. Anderson is the first one to describe a case series and showed this entity is different from celiac. And these patients have atrophied pancreas and also cystic lesions in the pancreas. So that's where the name either CF and also in Europe, it's called mucoviscidosis sometimes. So the patients are characterized to have pancreas with thick secretion, which kind of like giving the name what we call CF now. So in 1930s, it's the median predicted lifespan for the infants is less than a year. So most of the kids unfortunately succumb to malnutrition and they develop like severe macronutrient deficiencies and then also fat soluble vitamin deficiency. So the majority of the kids did not live beyond 1 year at the time. And then due to advances one by one, the two big ways of managing or two pillars of management is one is managing the respiratory infections or respiratory exacerbations. Then you can categorize the second group as nutritional intervention. So these are the game changers. And the latest estimates say that the median survival is projected more than 50 years now. So the major milestones in CF world is the gene was described somewhere like in 1989. And then, as I said, the newborn screen was made universally in the US in 2010 or 2011. So that kind of a early diagnosis, early institution of treatment, so that definitely help in evolution of in CF management. And the pancreatic enzymes, the availability of highly effective pancreatic enzymes. So it's funny, like initially when Dr. Anderson described, it used to be a GI disease because patients were so malnourished and they died before even they developed the pulmonary manifestations. So once the enzymes came into existence, then the kind of the gears change a little bit. So now predominantly it's a respiratory condition, but then still plays a big role in managing CF patients. There was an excellent seminal paper in which was published in 1988 by Corey and colleagues. So it's very fascinating because they took two big centers in North America. The population in each and every center was closer to 500 CF patients. And they showed that one center, the median lifespan was in closer to 21, and then the other center it was closer to 30. And the patient population, the mutations, their respiratory involvement between the centers were almost very identical, except that the center with longer lifespan had a more aggressive nutritional approach compared to the other one. So that's where the first impression about the nutrition, how nutrition modulates the CF outcome, the thought process kind of evolved. And since then, number of studies have shown that the better the nutritional status, patients do really well. Mm-hmm. So the CF, especially for people who are not familiar with CF, in US, closer to 30,000 people live in US with CF. Even though it's a smaller number, relatively smaller number to compare to other diseases we manage, these patients, they have huge, are highly complex medical needs. So the chances of seeing them both in inpatients, outpatients, in the ICUs are higher. The common manifestations of CF include respiratory involvement, either end-stage respiratory failure or frequent pulmonary exacerbations. With a lung transplant, the transplant team sees patients before and after transplant. After the respiratory tract, pancreas, about 85% of patients with CF have pancreatic insufficiency. So with pancreatic enzyme replacement, it's both the art and science. Our dietitians help us in managing the manifestations of steatorrhea every time patients come. And apart from pancreatic insufficiency, patients do have GI manifestations as the CFTR protein is expressed throughout the GI tract. About 10% of patients do have liver disease also. And going back to the pancreas, apart from exocrine pancreatic insufficiencies, about half the adults do have diabetes as well. So it's basically it's a primary model of condition where it's every discipline, it's a truly interdisciplinary with pulmonologists, with the dietitian, respiratory therapist, nurse coordinator, pharmacist, physical therapist, occupational therapist, gastroenterologist, endocrinologist. So it's truly, and I think I'm missing few, but it's just patient-centered and it's a truly interdisciplinary approach.
Ready to keep these patients healthy, growing well, and free of complications, morbidity, and mortality. Now, speaking of, dietitians and the role for, dietitians in the care of a CF patient, I think previously when we were talking, you mentioned some possible training opportunities that could be available.
Yeah. So as I mentioned about DIGES, is an acronym stands for Developing Innovative Gastroenterology Specialty training in CF. So that's focus for adult and pediatric gastroenterologists. And the foundation is so generous and foundation recognizes the importance of training the other disciplines who are not familiar with CF. As I mentioned that it's a condition which requires a lot of exposure to CF and the uniqueness, the interdisciplinary nature, things like that. So the endocrinologists, they have a training pathway. It's called Envision. Apart from that, there are training pathways available for nurse coordinators, dietitians, new dietitians coming to the CFO, social workers, pharmacists. I think the most of the information are available in the foundation website. And also the CF Center Director will be another big good resource person for people who are interested in this, in listening this, to reach out to the directors to get more information.
Thank you. Now, we know that not all exocrine pancreatic insufficiency is CF. So can you tell me a little bit more about your thought process when you're evaluating patients with EPI?
That's a good question, Christian. So like at least, so here I would probably divide into pediatrics and adults. So in pediatrics, the most common condition we see with pancreatic insufficiency is cystic fibrosis. And so that forms major chunk of the patients with pancreatic insufficiency we see in pediatric. And the other conditions include kids who have chronic recurrent pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis. Either chronic acute pancreatitis or chronic pancreatitis. As they get more and more episodes, they can have more ongoing pancreatic damage resulting in pancreatic insufficiency. And apart from these two conditions, we also do see other congenital conditions such as Schwarzman-Diamond or Pearson-Marrow syndrome. And there are like another list of rarer genetic conditions where pancreatic insufficiency could be a presentation of those conditions. In adult world, apart from CF, patients with chronic pancreatitis, it's also one of the common conditions with pancreatic insufficiency. And pancreatic malignancies, either due to malignancy obstructing the pancreatic duct, or patients undergoing surgeries after, like as part of the treatment of the malignant process, can also become pancreatic insufficient. Those are the common ones in adults. We have some screening tests to look for pancreatic insufficiency. The one commonly used is fecal elastase or stool elastase, which is a good starting point. But then if there are questions, there are more confirmatory tests available in centers, in specialized centers. One is an endoscopy, a pancreatic stim test. And oftentimes imaging such as MRI or what we call MRCP with secretin enhanced MRCP also will help in evaluating these patients.
Now, I know that even pancreatic enzyme technology has also advanced over the past few years. And there are now medical devices that can be used to help with these patients. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's another interesting thing. So before 1950s, the enzymes available were not of highly effective nature. So once we have more highly effective enzymes that improve the nutrition of the CF patients drastically, we have about 3-4 brands available. And broadly, we can divide the enzymes into non-entry-coated and entry-coated. The entry-coated are more efficient. Even with newborns, we can open the capsules and we can feed the babies and we can avoid the pancreatic supplementation. And again, as I said, the science part is very straightforward. Everyone can understand, but there's a lot of artwork. And our dietitians produce so many innovative ways of even administering enzymes to babies who has not even mastered swallowing the solids will be able to take those micro beads. So it's very innovative and a lot of it's that's where the uniqueness of training people in CF comes. So that's there. And then recently, and within the past 4 years, we have a special device called Reliza, which has a immobilized lipase cartridge. So before the invention of this device, there was no standard protocols available for how you treat. So again, going back, so when patients need enzymes, we treat them every time they eat based on calculating their lipase concentration, sorry, the lipid concentration of the mm-hmm. food. Seeing how much lipids they're able to take or they're going to take and then dose accordingly, are based on body weight. The body weight is a little bit simple for people who struggle to calculate the lipid concentrations every time. So the based on body weight is a little bit straightforward. And so again, our dietitian colleagues help our patients to get used to it. And then also based on their symptoms, based on their improvement, we can titrate the enzymes, the doses of enzymes also. And most of the CF patients, we feed them, we give the enteral feedings at night. We don't have your evidence-based guidelines to see what's the best way to supplement the enzymes when they take tube feeds. And practically, most of the patients take enzymes before they start the tube feeds and after they wake up from sleep in the morning. But when the relays up, when the immobilized cartridge was available, it helped them to, so we can, it's ex vivo, which means that the cartridge actually stays it's attached outside the patient, and the formula goes through the cartridge, and the lipase attached to the cartridge helps in digestion of the lipids. So it's a very innovative way of like helping the patients digest the fat, and then that digested formula enters the body. So that's another big advantage for feeding the or treating the patients with CF in the recent times. Another reason advancement in the CF management is the therapies, the CFTR directed therapies, what we call modulators. So the prior therapies were mostly to treat the symptoms, like to, as I said, enhancing the nutritional status, treating the respiratory exacerbations, infections with antibiotics, other respiratory medications, things like that. Whereas now with advancement in science, there are CFTR directed therapies that are available. So basically what happens in CF, in patients with CF, is the gene deletion in the CF gene or CFTR gene, the protein we encode, which is called CFTR, which is the ion channel, which helps us to keep the secretions in our body thin. So when there is a mutation there, the secretions are acidic and also thick, which is responsible for majority of the manifestations of CF. So these newer therapies are directly directed towards the CFTR dysfunction and helping to correct or aim to improve the CFTR function. The initial one was called ivacaftor, which is a highly effective modulator, but only a small percentage of CF patients were eligible for the mutations were eligible for that therapy. But in 2019, there was another a modulator was invented, which is called Trikafta. So it has three medications, elisacaftor, tesacaftor, and ivacaftor. So this one, it's patients with at least one copy of Delta 508, which is the most common mutation in CF, became eligible. So with this advent of this medication, about 80-85% of cystic fibrosis patients are eligible now and on this therapy. So that changed the landscape of management. Again, going back to the nutritional needs in CF, so I did allude about like patients will have pancreatic insufficiency resulting in malabsorption. So that's one reason for malnutrition. There are other reasons as well, like people having a repeated respiratory involvement, their needs are higher, and it's an inflammatory disease. So the inflammation also interferes with increased needs. And then also patients having sinusitis, patients having recurrent cough, their intake could be smaller. And then in addition to that, having a liver disease, which is about in 10% of or less than 5% of patients, or having diabetes, all those causes, all those cause additional challenges in nutrition. Whereas with the CFTR directed therapy, which is directed towards CFTR, a lot of these manifestations drastically improve. So the main improvement is in the lungs. For the GI involvement or improvement, we still need more data, more longitudinal long-term data to see how that impacts. But patients with on CFTR modulators such as Trikafta, their respiratory status improves a lot. So now, as I said, the landscape of nutrition is changing. Previously, all the patients we were treating with what we call legacy diet or CF legacy diet, which is rich in calories and high in fat. So now it's a more individualized approach. So more like a precision medicine or precision nutrition. And the other uniqueness about CF is, even though two patients having same mutations may have different clinical expression or different phenotypic expression. So if we end up in treating both with the same medications or same nutritional advice, one person will be overweight or obese, the other person may be normal in nutrition. So it's basically, especially in the era of CFTR modulators, we need an individualized approach. So the legacy diet, what I call, it's becoming less and less relevant nowadays, and kind of more individualized approaches are being carried out.
Well, thank you for that review, Sandro. You know, as somebody who doesn't do much CF and I only see these patients in the hospital when I'm consulted, I am heavily reliant on our CF expert here at our facility as well. But that was just a very thorough review and definitely sounds like a very, like you mentioned, I think it's a science, but it's also an art in supporting these patients nutritionally. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit. I think you had mentioned that you also spent some time on research. Can you tell me a little bit more about how nutrition and your research work intersect?
Again, as I have to say that I'm just kind of like getting my feet wet. So my research in CF, I have an excellent team on the basic sciences side. And I did a little bit basic sciences during fellowship. So I don't have a lab, I don't work in lab, but I do collaborate with the CF team. And it's a win-win situation. There's a lot of exposure for me to learn from them. And then also I provide some clinical perspective for my bench scientists. Even though I do one day of CF in a week, interacting with them. So that's like every Mondays I have lab meetings with them. And then Friday we have your CF meet where all the basic sciences on a rotation basis we do present. That helps me to, and my focus is I'm taking a little bit more steps in microbiome, like how CFTR kind of interacts with microbiome or dysbiosis, and how these modulators kind of impact. So I'm kind of like doing some work in both clinical side as well as in the basic sciences side. So that's there. And then apart from CF, my other research interest is the big data. So I do have collaborate with few people, a few of my colleagues in evaluating the outcome based, like especially like the impact of malnutrition in chronic diseases or acute diseases such as pancreatitis, RCF, or CF liver disease, things like that. So that's my other passion.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that. That's excellent. Thank you for sharing that. Now, Sandal, I know we just recently met at Tampa for the Aspen conference. What were the highlights of the conference for you?
Again, it's a great conference. And like every year, I do see that like how the nutrition world is evolving. Like previously, there was big focus on like outcome, especially in pediatrics, weight gain, things like that. Whereas now I do see that we are learning more and more, or like we kind of like diving deeper into other components like body composition, or metabolism, or the microbiome interactions, individualized nutritional approaches, nutrinomics, things like that. So it's really fascinating. I think we have a lot of work to do. As we always kind of say in nutrition, it's a little bit harder to do, at least in pediatrics, longer prospective trials, but we still need it. We still kind of like need to do a lot of work needs to be done. But I feel like we are moving in the right direction, even though it is slower pace. So a lot of like outcome-based, a lot of individualized nutritional therapies and things like that. It's fascinating for me.
Well, I know that I was supposed to participate in this, but I know that you did. You were part of the poster professor program at Aspen. Can you tell me more about what that is and how that went?
This is the first year I participated. It was a wonderful experience, and I have to thank Aspen for it. It just helps the first time attendees or junior people to kind of like to get your like. A glimpse of like what the work is being done and kind of the varieties of like research going on, things like that. So I was really excited about that program, and I'm looking forward for it in the coming years as well.
Excellent. Well, Senthil, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I think it's been such a great review about nutrition and the world of CF. I learned a lot. Thank you for spending this time.
Thank you, Vikram. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Aspen, for making this possible.